Welcome to Jurisdictions, an Asset Institute podcast. My name is Carl Lewis, and I will be your host. For those who enjoyed our Hague Courts Dialogue series, this is still very much the place where decisions of courts and tribunals in The Hague, as well as contemporary developments concerning them, are discussed in detail. However, we thought a slight refresh was in order, so to better capture the podcast's aim of providing you, the listener, with many more discussions on matters of international law, some of which may go beyond the practice of the courts here in The Hague. For instance, kicking off this new format, this episode focuses on maps, the symbolic geographical representations of the world we live in, and the role they can play in territorial disputes. What role do maps play in the international legal order and the decision-making of international courts? To explain why the question of maps grabbed our attention recently, I'm delighted to be joined by Miranda Lala as co-host, who's currently completing the Advanced Masters in Public International Law at Leiden University and who co-produced this episode. Miranda, why are we talking about maps today?
A few months ago, at the peak of the Barbenheimer craze, I noted that, out of the two films in the double feature, it was not the one about nuclear weapons generating controversy in international politics. It was the one about a children's toy. You see, at a pivotal point in Barbie, the protagonist discovers that, to resolve an existential crisis, she must venture from Barbie land to the real world. Before taking off in her pink plastic convertible, a scene is included in which she looks to a crayon-drawn map of the world to plan out her journey to Venice Beach, California. If this is all sounding quite comical to you, well, that's because this movie is, indeed, a comedy. Yet, shortly before its release, a representative of the Vietnamese state announced the ban of its screening in Vietnam, a sanction presumably forming part of the Vietnamese government's once-stated aim of restricting foreign content which, and I quote, distorts historical facts, denies revolutionary achievements, or infringes upon national sovereignty, end quote. Barbie's crime? Her crayon-drawn map dotted with flowers, turtles, dolphins, and a hashtag in what is presumably the Pacific Ocean contains, according to Vietnamese cinema regulators, the offending image of the nine-dash line. The infamous nine-dash line is a representation of Chinese claims in the South China Sea, often featured on maps produced by the country. The line departs from the Chinese mainland and hooks around an area encompassing the exclusive economic zones of neighboring countries. There is no doubt that the nine-dash line is a matter of significance to the states bordering the South China Sea. But Warner Brothers, the production studio behind the Barbie movie, firmly contends that the map on which it allegedly appears was not, and I quote, intended to make any statement. States seem to take maps very seriously, no matter the context.
To help us understand why, we are joined by William Worster, senior lecturer at the Hague University of Applied Sciences and author of The Frailties of Maps as Evidence, published in the Journal of International Dispute Settlement. If you're wondering whether states really take maps this seriously, well, Worster is in no doubt.
States take maps very seriously, and dedicate a considerable amount of resources, not only to making them, but also to monitoring the maps that are produced by others, even in things as sort of silly as popular media. The map is a critical depiction, and it could be for a very direct purpose, like the Temple case, where one state presents a map and the other state fails to object to that map, and then that has immediate legal consequences. But it also has a slightly larger implication, which is how we even imagine the legitimacy of a particular territorial entity in its full scope. So we have seen Russia, Turkey, other states produce official state maps that claim far more territory than they actually have. And they will produce this map and they will broadcast it. And it's sometimes quite startling what these look like. The question is, are they expressing some kind of hostility to the other states in the region? Is that expressing aggressive intention? I mean, we remember from the interim accord case at the ICJ and Greece's deep concern at the name of the state Macedonia and its relationship with the Greek region, and that somehow the name of the state could have hostile intentions. Well, the similar things happen when states produce memorabilia coins or will produce a kind of flag or something fun. Even in the interim accord case, Greece alleged that Macedonia was producing maps in children's textbooks, for example. These are not necessarily rising to the level of sort of official statements, but the question is, states might perceive a kind of unfriendly act or kind of hostility, or maybe even, if they're paranoid enough, a kind of a threat to their sovereignty. And then even so, when we look at private actors and the kinds of maps that they're making. So you have the Barbie movie and you have all these other examples where a private actor, sort of a company or whatever, has produced something that a state feels could give the wrong implication. So China, for example, has complained when people can go into websites that have drop-down menus and provide a list of different countries that you select where you're from. And if they list Taiwan as a state in that, then China will complain. It's not a map, but it's complaining about the depiction of its territory and a depiction of its sovereignty in something as simple as a sort of drop-down selection box. So states are very, very concerned about maps. They're looking at both state and non-state actors and constantly monitoring the kinds of maps that they're producing.
It may come as no surprise, at least for the international lawyer, that questions of territorial sovereignty are one of, if not the key reason, states take maps extremely seriously. After all, stakes are extremely high in territorial disputes. Professor Krista Wiegand from the Department of Political Science at the University of Tennessee, co-author of The Peaceful Resolution of Territorial and Maritime Disputes, explains why this is so.
Territorial disputes are the number one cause of war, and there's a good reason for this. Territory is often tied to high levels of nationalism, national identity, a sense of belonging for the public, and symbolism overall. Even when there is no tangible value, such as the case of a barren island, the territory is often perceived by the government and the public as valuable and sometimes critical to the homeland, its identity, and its security. One only needs to consider China's decades-long determination to seek sovereign control of Taiwan to understand how territorial claims are often perceived. Unless territory is uninhabited without any people living there, all other disputed issues are secondary by default, economic and so forth, because territory provides people with the right to live in a certain location and have the protections provided by sovereignty. So without sovereignty, without territory, everything else is secondary. Now, while many disputes have been peacefully settled, there have been many wars over territory, including in the late 20th century and even into the early 21st century. And there are dozens of disputes remaining today because the states involved are not willing to consider conceding any territory, or in some cases, the disputes are beneficial to the state to maintain.
If territory is such an integral part of state identity, why would states take a gamble and go to an external adjudicative body with their dispute? And since international adjudication can be a zero-sum game, meaning a ruling in favor of one could entail the loss of the other, are there strategies employed by states seeking to maximize their chances?
Because of the central role of territory for the status of a state's sovereignty, governments of states involved in territorial disputes must carefully consider whether there's an incentive to try to resolve a dispute peacefully in the first place, and if they do choose to do so, what is the best means by which to seek peaceful resolution? The consequences of losing territory can be significant. Actually, losing territory, turning over sovereignty to another state, is a major outcome. If people are living in that territory, obviously the consequences are massive. If the territory is uninhabited, the loss is generally more symbolic. There are several resolution methods, of course, and arbitration and adjudication, of course, are the most legalized methods. States choose adjudication because they want to reduce uncertainty to win the disputes, avoid losing if they believe their legal claims can survive in the courts. States are very strategic about the choice of this venue, and they're trying to maximize their choice of winning the dispute. There are several strategies that they use, both in selecting the adjudication or arbitration, for example, and they also can use strategies once they get to the court. States are choosing adjudication for several reasons. First, when they believe their legal claims are the strongest and will survive jurisdiction, of course. When they themselves or other regional states with similar claims have had positive experiences with the courts or arbitration. and when domestic law is similar to the mechanism used by international courts. For example, civil law states are more likely to use adjudication compared to common law states because courts tend to follow rules more similar to civil law traditions. And all of these factors make it more likely for states to seek adjudication to resolve their territorial disputes. There are ways that states can be strategic about adjudication regarding framing their legal claims that they bring to the court. Governments can use calculated decisions of legal arguments and rephrasing their sovereignty claims within the framework of the selected venue of where they go. They can also focus on certain aspects of the dispute, for example, leaving out certain claims that could be lead to an unfavorable outcome. For example, because the ICJ takes into account the facts that the applicant identifies as the basis for its legal claim, states discriminate between potential claims that may be brought to the court and choose claims that are likely to hold up against arguments of the other side. Another way to be strategic is through the careful selection of legal counsel based on their past experience in disputes with similar legal claims. There are public law firms that are known for resolving these territorial disputes and representing states in territorial dispute resolution. And states are very careful. Governments spend a lot of time interviewing, reviewing the past record, reviewing their case involvement, and really studying the strategies that used by legal counsel. So even before they get to the court, when they are coming up with their political and legal strategy to try to win a dispute, they're spending a lot of time being very strategic. Governments using the ICJ can also request a smaller chamber of five judges instead of the whole bench of 15 judges. And this is an example of when governments or specifically legal counsel try to adapt the rules and procedures. This is much more, this is much easier to do with arbitration panels, but it is possible to adapt some of the rules and procedures in adjudication. And finally, going back to the initial choice of venue, governments may stay away from a particular court due to the makeup of the legal background of judges or the record of prior decisions made about similar cases with similar legal claims. And all of these are ways that states can reduce uncertainty by being strategic, both in their selection of a certain venue and method of adjudication, as well as when they finally get to the court and how they actually bring their claims to the court.
When preparing this episode, we considered the role maps have played in the ongoing arbitral award of the 3rd of October 1899 case between the Cooperative Republic of Guyana and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela at the International Court of Justice. On the 29th of March 2018, Guyana instituted proceedings against Venezuela at the ICJ, requesting the court to confirm the legality and bindingness of an arbitral award from 1899. An award that delimited a boundary between the colony of British Guyana and the United States of Venezuela. In 1905, an Anglo-Venezuelan Boundary Commission had demarcated the boundary that the award established in the form of a map. Guyana claimed that Venezuela at no point contested the boundary demarcation after either the 1899 award or the 1905 agreement, not at least until 1962, when Guyana's independence from the United Kingdom was on the horizon. It was at this point, Guyana argued, 63 years after the original award, that Venezuela formally claimed the award to be null and void, and quoting from the application, threatened not to recognize the new state or its boundaries unless the United Kingdom agreed to set aside the 1899 award and the 1905 agreement and cede to Venezuela all of the territory west of the Essequibo River, which is awarded to British Guyana in 1899. End of quote. To this day, Venezuela contests the validity of the boundary demarcation. And it was reported that on the 3rd of December 2023, over 90% of Venezuelan voters voted in favor of claiming sovereignty over the Essequibo region of Guyana in a non-binding referendum called by the incumbent president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. Following the results, Maduro held a speech while sporting a jacket that depicted a small map of Venezuela. And notably, the map depicted the Essequibo region too, as forming part of the whole. A map which Maduro would later present as the new official map of Venezuela. Not long after, the United Kingdom sent warships to the coast of Guyana in show of support for the former British colony. Maduro, in reply, ordered thousands of military personnel to engage in exercises I quote, of a defensive nature in response to the provocation and threat of the UK against peace and the sovereignty of our country, end quote. It may seem self-evident, but why should we care about maps in such a case before the International Court of Justice?
Whenever there's a dispute and it's going to be litigated at the court, there is, of course, the initial little bit of theater that goes with any kind of a legal argumentation that we have to put together and how we want to frame this particular dispute. So when the parties are presenting the case, if they present a map, that map can have a very important visual impact on the case that's going forward. If we think about the arbitral award of the 3rd October 1899 case, one of the things that's so remarkable about this case is that Venezuela is effectively asking that the border ought to be recognized and they should undermine the arbitral award and the border should be recognized as being elsewhere. If I was legal counsel for Guyana, I would love to present a picture of the map, because what the map shows is that effectively Venezuela wants half of the entire state territory of Guyana. That's a pretty shocking, in many ways, very radical claim. So if you're framing the case and you're standing here before all the judges and you say, you know, look what they want. They want, and of course, this is a court that's based on upholding peace and justice. And you say, look what they want. Just look at the map and you can see what they want. It has a really dramatic effect. So from just how you frame the argument, it can be quite important.
But what role have maps played in the border dispute at the heart of the arbitral award of the 3rd of October 1899 case? We asked Dr. Brendan Plant, Hopkins Parry Fellow and Director of Studies in Law at Downing College, University of Cambridge, and author of International Law and the Adjudication of Territorial Disputes, forthcoming Oxford University Press.
If you ask a broad question like that about maps, the answer is different at different stages. There are clearly maps involved in the arbitral process that led to the award of 1899. And then we have an interesting phase. Perhaps I might back up a little bit and say one of the things that's important to be aware of when dealing with disputes concerning territory is that there are a few different processes involved. So we will have a delimitation of a boundary, which is the articulation of the principles upon which an international frontier, a boundary separating two sovereign states, will be established, which will then invariably be followed by a demarcation, which is a much more technical process, which involves sketching out, marking out on the face of the earth, the line which gives effect to the principles stated in the delimitation. So they're slightly different but complementary processes, both of which will usually be required in order to produce a boundary which is knowable to the local inhabitants, to the people who actually live there, which is stable by virtue of being knowable and which hopefully will remain respected for some time. So the second stage in which maps become relevant to these overall proceedings is in the post-arbitral award phase, when a demarcation commission, effectively a boundary commission, was charged with the task of marking out a boundary that gave effect to the to the delimitation that was issued by the Arbitral Tribunal in its 1899 award. And I believe that demarcation process yielded a declaration which the two states signed, acknowledging that this was an official process, and a map, in fact, two maps, which were then acknowledged as being fair copies of and official copies of the process. That's 1905 that process finished. But of course, there's we're returning to, well, I'm not going to say scene of the crime, but we're returning to revisit that process, because obviously Venezuela has rejected the validity of this award, on the basis of allegations that the 1899 award was a result of a political bargain struck among the great powers, in particular, we're talking about the British, Russians, and Americans, and that therefore this award should not be recognized as binding. So what role might MAPS play in this ICJ proceedings? We don't know. This could very well be a case that turns entirely on the question of the validity of the arbitral agreement and not stretch back to reconsider the territorial dispute which gave rise to those arbitral proceedings in the first place.
So, though the case concerns a territorial boundary dispute, the 1899 arbitral award case does not revolve primarily around a map as a central component of the dispute. In fact, for Dr. Plan, the answer as to what role a specific map may have to do with this case is pretty straightforward.
So it doesn't really turn very much on the map per se. The Venezuelan complaint, to the extent that they have expressed it over the decades and given voice to it in documents which they submitted irregularly for the consideration of the ICJ during the preliminary phase of these proceedings, is that the award was rendered not on the basis of the application of law to facts, but was a political bargain struck by the powers. So that this was horse trading dressed up as and given formal effect as a binding award, whereas in fact it bears none of the markers of an arbitral decision. This is not a legal process yielding an outcome that should be respected as legal. So I don't think there's any particular objections to the course of the frontier on the map or any such thing. It's the process which yielded the notion of there being a fair, shall we say, rule of law-based agreement when in fact it was a political bargain.
As mentioned by Dr. Plant, at the core of this dispute lies an alleged political bargain. The Secretary of the Commission to Demarcate the Boundary Line between Venezuela and British Guiana, who later served as counsel for Venezuela in the 1899 arbitration, left a memorandum to a colleague about circumstances of the ultimate award. But this letter was only to be published after his death. In the letter, Mallet Prevost describes an event that occurred shortly after the court adjourned, while the judges were supposed to be rendering their decision. He, as counsel for Venezuela, was convened to the hotel room of the two American judges, Fuller and Brewer. Here's what transpired, according to the letter. "When I was shown into the apartment where the two American arbitrators were waiting for me, Justice Brewer arose and said excitedly, 'Mallet Prevost, it is useless any longer to keep up this farce, pretending that we are judges and that you are counsel. The chief and I have decided to disclose to you confidentially just what has passed.'" Judge Brewer goes on to explain that Martins, a Russian arbitrator on the case put forward by Britain, and the same of the infamous Martins Clause, has struck a political deal with the two British judges. By the terms of this deal, Martins and the British judges would rule in favor of the Schomburg line, which leaves to Venezuela the control of the Orinoco mouth and 5,000 square miles of territory around that mouth. The judges had to decide whether or not to vote in favor and sought Mallet Prevost's counsel, curiously, as he was representative of a party to the conflict. Mallet Prevost recounts in his letter that he went to the house of former U.S. President Benjamin Harrison, who also served as an attorney for the Republic of Venezuela. He said, "Mallet Prevost, if it should ever be known that we had it in our power to save for Venezuela the mouth of the Orinoco and failed to do so, we should never be forgiven. What Martins proposes is iniquitous, but I see nothing for Fuller and Brewer to do but to agree." Mallet Prevost concludes, "I concurred with General Harrison, and so advised Chief Justice Fuller and Justice Brewer. The decision which was accordingly rendered was unanimous, but while it gave to Venezuela the most important strategic point at issue, it was unjust to Venezuela and deprived her of a very extensive and important territory to which, in my opinion, Great Britain had not the shadow of a right." That last line concludes the letter. In this case, a map was alleged to represent a biased claim. Knowing that incidents like this could arise, How do courts take maps into consideration within their decision-making, especially as evidence?
Maps have a variety of roles. They can be put to a variety of uses. If you look at the case law of the ICJ, there are examples of maps serving as evidence of the location of a boundary, which can be tantamount in importance to an instrument or agreement that expresses the will of the parties where that map is integrated with that instrument. So you have a map which is annexed to a treaty, shall we say, a delimitation treaty. And if the map is annexed to it, it is fully part of that treaty and can serve effectively as legal title. That's exceptional because in all other situations, international courts and tribunals have traditionally taken a very cautious approach to the value of maps. They have known for a long time that maps can be based on relatively, gappy knowledge of the local conditions. They might be made by individuals with only a passing familiarity with the area that they have sketched. They may be individuals who are charged with a particular and partial task. So there's no objectivity or neutrality to the product that they have produced. Courts have known that for a very long time. And of course, in recent times, there is a stronger basis for thinking that visual depictions of geographical, geomorphological, hydrographic factors are more likely to be accurate. They'll be detailed. They will be technically sound because they may be based on satellite photography. They may be based on, you know, very close readings and measurements of a location. And if I might just point out at this point, let's not forget these locations change. Locations are dynamic. Geography is not as static as we tend to think. But there is perhaps we have a better basis for trusting the technical elements of map making nowadays. But none of the other things that I mentioned before about the purpose or the task assigned to the map maker is any different. You can have entirely self-serving maps produced today, just as you might have 150 years ago or beyond, in fact. I know that there are some very old maps relevant to the Guyana question that seek to chart out where some of the Dutch communities, for example, in the Essequibo Delta. But anyway, the courts have, I think, shown a greater readiness to attach a certain degree of value to maps as evidence, but it's still quite limited. As I say, when the map is integrated with an instrument or annexed to an instrument so that it can be characterized as an expression of the will of the parties, it is tantamount to the value of that instrument. It's as good as title. But in all of these other situations, the court views it as corroborative as best. So the map could work to help the court determine the proper interpretation of a boundary treaty. There may be contemporaneous maps available which show what the party's thinking was at the time they agreed to a particular textual formula. The map is not being given effect. It's assisting in giving meaning and effect to the treaty text. Equally, a map might serve as evidence of subsequent practice, which might show how the understanding interpretation of a particular map has evolved in the subsequent practice of the parties. And it's interesting to think about these examples. Eritrea, Ethiopia is an example. There's one sector in the boundary award in Ethiopia, Eritrea, where the line is different. The line recognized as the boundary today is different from as depicted because it was clear that the two parties acted as though the boundary was in a different place. That is rationalized as subsequent practice interpreting a boundary treaty so as to relocate in this particular instance, or rather to more accurately place the boundary somewhere else. Now, of course, it's probably relatively easy to invoke notions like subsequent practice for the interpretation of a treaty when you're looking at a boundary treaty, because there's only two parties. And there's a zero sum element to the location of a boundary. If I gain territory, it's at the expense of your, it's eating into your terrain and vice versa. So that's a phenomenon that can give a certain value to a map as well. Maps can serve as evidence of effectivité, of sovereign acts of administration. They can show that a state has sought to administer or regulate a certain area. Even, you know, research activities have been relevant for that in certain cases, like Eastern Greenland, for example. Maps have also been used as evidence of recognition. So a state can be deemed to have recognized, or perhaps implicitly recognized, what might be thought of in terms of acquiescence to the location of a particular line. The most famous example of that is the Pravaha temple case, where we have again a demarcation commission which drew up a map and which located the temple on the Cambodian side, or what was then the French side of the line. And the Thai government later came to object to and reject the course of the line as marked on the map, because they'd agreed on a delimitation principle that the boundary should follow the watershed. And they thought the line on the map departed from the watershed line. But the court found that the temple remains on the Cambodian side because of the acceptance, recognition, if you will, that Thailand had given to the territorial configuration through various ways, not least of which, of course, was attendance at an event where French state symbols, including the flag, were on display in the vicinity of the temple. So a map can assist to corroborate the evidence of this state act of consent, this evidence of state conduct. And then sometimes they can be used as evidence of general repute if you're looking to establish that the recognition of other states supports your claim to title over a particular territory. But it's a pretty weak basis for title and doesn't carry much weight at all. Finally, a map can simply serve as evidence of technical data. You know, there can be details, official information. It can be an expression of an opinion as to where something might be or should go, or of difficulties that could be encountered. And again, it's not going to be the most hefty form of evidence, but it could contribute to an overall collection of material that support a judicial finding of fact. It really is important in the court's reckoning when looking at maps, whether the degree of consistency that exists among maps, if there's a collection of them, or between maps and other types of information, and if there are any contradictions, that's more likely to scare the courts away from the maps, frankly. They're relatively unlikely to give much value to maps in those situations.
Worcester agrees here that courts are likely to take a cautious approach when it comes to maps. And in respect to the ICJ, well,
the court's not naive. It's very aware that maps can be that are produced by the parties are self-serving. And so it's open to them being contradicted. It's open for them being questioned. The court can even say, you know what, we really need to have a more neutral map here to get a sense of what's happening, because it's coming from one of the other parties and it's either inaccurate or poorly sourced or something like that.
But there seems to be one glaring problem for any search of neutrality when it comes to maps.
There really is no such thing as a neutral map. I mean, this is something that we might all aspire to, but it's basically impossible. Obviously, a map that's produced by a party to litigation, they're going to be motivated to frame it a certain way, to depict it a certain way, to have markings that produce certain types of indications in a certain way. The International Court of Justice can always, if it wants, appoint independent experts that are separate from the parties to do various investigations. And they certainly could call for an independent map or an independent mapping authority. And so that authority would be neutral in a sense that it's not coming from one of the parties or another. But that we shouldn't be blind to the fact that, of course, whatever that authority is doing is working for a particular purpose. So if, for example, that authority were to come from the United Nations or to come from an independent geographical institute or something like that, they would have to create a document with a certain end and purpose. So trying to depict something, and then there's all kinds of choices when you make a map. I mean, a map is a visual representation of the real world. And so it has to be filtered by you, by the map creator. So, you know, who is this creator? What is their expertise? What are the sources they're going to draw on? Are they just copying old maps and making a new one for the court? Or are they going to actually go out in the field and survey? I doubt that. So they have to find some kind of sources to base this on. And then what are those sources and what did they use and what is their basic evidence? So there's a whole variety of different things that you have to make choices on and exclude some data and have, you know, some degree of abstraction. It's never going to be completely perfect, because of course, in order to be perfect, it would have to be as big as the real world, and that's impossible. So the idea of having a map that's fully neutral is certainly very tempting, and we can certainly try to approach that by getting rid of some obvious influences. But ultimately, we are going to have to accept the fact that it is going to be limited by the fact that we are just humans, and we have a certain degree of only limited scientific ability to make a depiction.
There is, as of yet, no such thing as a neutral map. But there's more.
There's one thing actually that we didn't hit on that might be interesting to mention, and I can talk about it for a few seconds here. But this is the question of the court interpreting maps themselves. I mean, it's one thing for a court to sort of to say we can accept different sources of evidence and maybe they contradict each other and everything. But ultimately, when the court is using a map as a source of evidence, it has to then interpret the markings on the map. And it since the Vienna Convention on Law of Treaties interpretation talks about text and doesn't talk about maps, it's not quite clear what we're meant to do with that. So when, you know, China in the South China Sea produces a 9-dash line on a map, what do the dashes mean? Do the dashes mean that's the territorial waters that it's claiming? Does that mean that those are the particular islands that would have their own territorial waters in turn? Or is that the effective fishing zone of people in the past? Or what is that attempting to depict? And often those arguments will shift when we see maps with, you know, instead of a border line, but maybe a dashed line or a double line or sometimes a green line or a red line. And it's very confusing to try to figure out exactly what's meant by those things. And basically, what courts have to do is they have to think, what would effectively an ordinary person do when they make a green dashed line? What are they trying to depict? And then whatever that communication is, then that should have legal implications.
To sum up, international courts may be required to interpret maps of sections of the earth when deciding upon a case, while aware that the maps presented by the parties to a case cannot be neutral, as a matter of fact. Furthermore, even if such maps are presented in good faith by all parties, there is no universal language nor international legal framework to rely upon when it comes to interpret the markings on a map. This is fascinating, especially should we begin considering the role international courts can play through the resolution of territorial disputes in shaping international law and politics. As Professor Wiegand reflects,
I think there's an underestimation of the role of courts in shaping international law and even international politics, particularly. And the reason for that is in some cases, there's not compliance, of course, but in territorial disputes, compliance by international law and international decisions is actually quite high. And that's mainly because states that are going to the court are selecting into, of course, the decision to bring the case to the court, and they're willing to comply in most cases, not, of course, in every case. But at the same time, too, in addition to the compliance by the states themselves, I think that there are many other states who have territorial disputes, who have maritime disputes, who have other kinds of disputes, who are watching these cases, observing it. Even though there is not precedent the way there is in many domestic legal situations, there is customary international law, and states are watching this. They consider these cases as precedent in some way, not maybe legally, but politically. And these cases are brought up again and again and again over several decades in some cases. And so there's definitely impact by these cases, and they need to be reconsidered and brought up over and over again, and really not only treated by as important by the legal community, but also by governments and the political community in international politics.
There is, however, one set of actors that we have not yet discussed in detail. That is, the very individuals that will be directly and or indirectly affected by territorial disputes. Dr. Yusra Suwedi, lecturer in international law at the University of Manchester and author of The Individual in the Law and Practice of the International Court of Justice, forthcoming with Cambridge University Press, briefly explains for us why the court may not, however, factor in the impact of its decisions on local populations.
I would say that there are two main reasons. So the first one is the court's preoccupation with the stability of boundaries. So the stability of boundaries is a principle in international law. There's a lot of emphasis on it that is placed not only in the court's jurisprudence, but also in the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. So that's actually where it comes from, in Article 62, paragraph 2, letter A, which basically prohibits a fundamental change of circumstances with respect to boundary treaties. And the idea is that we don't really want any dangerous frictions or any disruption to what is essentially supposed to be an instrument of peaceful change. That's the way such boundary treaties are perceived. And they're supposed to even outlive the treaty itself and create an essentially a permanent reality for the states concerned. So that, I say, is the first thing that the court is really careful to respect, and understandably, given that it is responding or trying to resolve a dispute between states. And then the second reason, I would say, is legal formalism. So the concern of the court to really respect legal formalism, which essentially is a legal approach that wants us to exclusively hone in on the application of law, black letter law, without any consideration for anything that would be non-legal. So anything that might be sociocultural or economic or political or anything else, right? And the idea is that if we did consider those other non-legal elements, that it would somehow tarnish the way that we view and respect the law as something objective and neutral and credible, and perhaps, you know, the way that we view the court itself as a stable, dependable, neutral, and credible body. So I think that that's also a way to ensure that the court's relationship of trust with states remains intact.
Dr. Suwedi has also observed that arguments put forward by state litigants centered on the needs and desires of local populations, quote, have been rejected by the court, deemed pariahs of its decisive framework of reasoning in territorial boundary disputes, end of quote. There are a couple of potential reasons why this has been the case.
The first one is that I think that a court striving to resolve disputes peacefully can't really be said to have achieved that fully if affected people are somehow unsatisfied or even worse, possibly harmed by the decision. And certain judges have also expressed a similar view and a certain regret to reduce something like this to a purely geometric exercise. So in my view, that's not particularly effective. But more broadly, I think I would say that it's increasingly difficult to justify international law as a system that only serves states. It so obviously includes so many more actors and individuals are a huge part of it. And it's just, I think, increasingly necessary for that to be reflected, even in decisions like this. And I think that there's a large discourse happening in the international legal space today about inclusion and exclusion. And that matters as well in exercises like this. And we've seen so many different groups, communities, local populations, people, or mere individuals who really increasingly turn to international justice and particularly the world court to vindicate international laws as an important tool of protection, I think. So most recently, of course, we saw the Chagos case, and we have an advisory opinion pending about the Palestinian question and, of course, the Myanmar contentious dispute. And there's so many others that I can name. So I think that it's failing to include and properly consider people like that is it's somehow just unsatisfactory. And I think that it starts with something like territorial and maritime disputes. It's a step in the right direction, I think.
Building on this, Dr. Swaty provides us with a couple of reasons why it is important for the court to consider local inhabitants when drawing a territorial boundary.
If we look at a territorial boundary dispute, for example, the way that a frontier or a border might be delimited will possibly affect these people's nationality, their identity, their property rights. It might affect their living situation. And if we are looking at maritime boundary delimitation, that could particularly impact the fishing rights of coastal populations, many of whom consider traditional fishing rights to be not only a source of livelihood, but a very important part of their identity and their culture.
In this episode, we set out to discover what role maps play in the international legal order. Maps are not trivial things. Simple depictions of sovereignty have the power to shape state relations through their implications, going so far as to prompt interstate disputes. Because of the central role of territory to a state's identity, when disputes arise, states involved must carefully consider their adjudicative strategies. At this phase, maps can also play a crucial role. When drawing a map, we look to create something knowable and stable. Following the 1899 arbitral award, for example, a process of demarcation resulted in a map of the Essequibo region reflecting the agreement of the parties. Accordingly, at the core of this dispute lies Venezuela's claim that this depiction is null and void, a consequence of a political scandal tainting the arbitral process from which it resulted. However, when we consider the issue more closely, does a neutral map even exist? Courts are well aware of the particular strengths and weaknesses presented by this form of evidence. The purpose of a visual representation will depend on the circumstances of their creation, the matter in which they are invoked, and the facts of the dispute. Their authority will vary accordingly. At the end of the day, maps matter, not only for their impact on states, but also on the individuals living in the real world they represent.
Thank you, Miranda. And thank you to all our guests for their insights on this episode, as well as you, the listener, for joining in. If there is a specific international legal issue, concept, or case that you would like us to cover, please feel free to write to us at jurisdictions@asa.nl. And of course, if you enjoyed this episode, please do not forget to like and subscribe to this podcast, as well as to share it amongst others. We look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Jurisdictions podcast.